When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Look at the screen. William Blix, the great red dragon, and the woman clothed in the rays of the sun. Do you see?
I know that I'm not smart.
Then how did you catch me?
You had disadvantages.
What disadvantages?
You're insane.
Do you see?
You're so sly. So am I.
Do you see?
You're supposed to be his friend, Jack. Why didn't you leave him alone?
Do you see? Mrs. Leeds, do you see?
Yes.
You want the scent?
Smell yourself. Do you see?
Just you and me now, sport.
Do you see?
You've seen these films, haven't you, my man?
You owe me all.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Mindhunter. This is a podcast examining Michael Mann's 1986 adaptation of Thomas Harris's Red Dragon, Manhunter. Today, I'm joined by a person who brings nothing but joy to me and many people on the movie-loving internet. You may have seen his moniker for himself online, which is Tom Regan's Hat, or at Rufus T. Superfly on Twitter. It is Andy I'm talking today. He's keeping his anonymity, but bless his heart that he is, because man alive, I just want to say, Andy, thank you so much for coming and being a part of anything on One Heat Minute Productions. I just want to say you spark joy. You take the piss, as Australians and Brits would say, at such a level that it just impresses me to no end. Thank you for joining me on this latest Michael Mann miniseries, Manhunter. Manhunter.
My pleasure, Blake. My pleasure.
How are you? How are you?
Pardon?
How are you, my friend?
Yeah, very well. Thank you today. It's a bit it's wet and dull over here in Britain, as you'd expect. But otherwise, all good. All good. Very happy.
Excellent. Seasons are changing.
They are indeed.
It's getting in Oz. It's just spring. And spring is kind of sprung. And what that means for us is that temperatures are warming up, which is beautiful, but it's also windy as all hell. So we're kind of being blown around the streets of Sydney. So speaking of blown around the streets, we are about to be the third examination of a great scene. I kind of am spoiling myself as the host of this show, and hopefully spoiling the listeners with unpacking Manhunter, which I believe is kind of unheralded as Michael Mann god mode in 86. He's just absolutely killing it. And so we're going to be doing a scene that some folks have heard picked apart in all sorts of ways. But in your life, you've actually taught this scene to students, which I was so excited to sort of get your insights on it. But tell me a little bit about your love of Manhunter, and why particularly where we're in the cell with Brian Cox's Hannibal Lecter and Will Graham.
Well, I saw it in so it came out, as you said, in 86, and it didn't do well. But I'd been following Mann's career, even though I was very young then, because of Thief. When I eventually saw Thief, probably late night on BBC Two. BBC Two, I'd say. And I was immediately, you know, fascinated by the whole look and style. I love James Caan anyway. That's probably what brought me into it first. But then I noticed very quickly that Mann, you know, who I hadn't heard of, had this very distinctive visual style. And And just simple things also, like his direction of actors, like, you know, you see people like Robert Prosky, who I knew from, I think it was Hill Street Blues, that way around. And then I saw him as this, you know, terrifying, even though he seems avuncular at first, terrifying mob boss. So just all these aspects, but particularly the style of it, it really hit me. And then I was a student, I was a university student, and I think I saw it at a rep cinema, Manhunter, and quite simply, I was blown away by it. And I read the novel, and I was fascinated by the fidelity to it on the whole, even though I understood, even though I wish he'd done it, but the way he didn't keep the ending, which is incredibly grim, but to me, very true to the arc of the novel. But I get it. I mean, if Mann had done that, I mean, it blew it. It didn't do well anyway. But if he kept that ending, I can't even imagine what it would have been like. But then when I became a teacher, I was allowed to set up film, one of the first places to set up film as an aid. And I thought, I couldn't believe that you could do film studies. This was back in 1989. And it took off. And I started fairly immediately, because I was getting obsessed with the film, I started using Manhunter, and in particular, the interview in the cell, because I thought that it was man cooking on all levels, basically. The editing, the cinema, you know, obviously Spinotti, but I mean that the whole conception of the scene, I thought was incredibly striking, and my students always responded to it as well. You know, I explained the context of it, but then we went into great detail about the subtext of the dialogue, about the framing of it, and the editing. And actually, I mean, I love Cox anyway. Cox is what immediately struck me. But I found Peterson's performance extraordinary, and I still do. And I know some people put it down, or they don't think he's doing much. I don't think they seem to realise, when you see it in that, when you see his performance in that scene, the subtlety that he's using with his facial expressions and the way he's controlling himself, and then, of course, losing control on an extremely subtle level, I just found extraordinary, basically. And my students started responding to it as well. So, yeah, I carried on then doing it for actually literally decades, going over that scene with new classes.
I love
the music, of course, the ambient music.
I love what you said there. The thing that you touched on the most is it's easy to get lost sometimes in the Brian Cox of it all, because he's just,
he is just
a force to be. He's got a gravitational pull, and we're going to get into that.
That's a great way of putting it.
And, but the subtlety of someone totally losing their composure is so brilliant from Peterson.
That's what stands out to me more and more over the years.
Yes.
Peterson's performance. He has a, and I'm, again, I don't know whether you've discussed this with other people, but I mean that flat effect that he uses in his voice intentionally. He's trying not to give anything away with his body language anyway, but also with his voice. He's, you know, and I think that's why some people are confused by his performance, but you realize that it's the characters, it's totally intentional, because he's trying to control his voice so that Lecter, as you know, he's a human lie detector, is trying to look for anything in Graham to get into him. And he does, and he still does.
I love what you said there. He's a human lie detector. So what do you do when you're trying to beat a lie detector test? It's like, you know.
That's right.
The great Seinfeld line, it's not a lie if you believe it. thanks to George Costanza for that one. But no, he's actively, it's like people in a shark cage. He's lowering
his
heart rate. He's breathing slowly. And so I think I'm excited to talk to you about it. I get to relish auditing your class live and being a student of one. So the rest of the class be damned. Let's get this lesson in session. Ladies and gents, we are, as you've heard on the podcast so far, we are in the Lecter scene, and it is, because it is the most readily available, It's 21 minutes and 34 seconds is basically where we start the scene. If you're watching the director's cut, that's 21 minutes and 26 seconds. It's slightly different because there's no sort of stuff at the beginning, and this isn't really changed much whatsoever. It's kind of perfectly encapsulated in the director's cut too. There's no changes there. When there will be changes, I promise you, we'll dive into some of those extra scenes that don't really have a place in this theatrical cut. But let's dive into the scene. Andy and I now are going to unpack it and pick it apart. And as we do, we're going to go back, we're going to go forward, we're going to stop things, we're going to discuss, and you guys are going to listen along and we're going to talk about it.
So I find it very interesting from the beginning. Obviously, that it's highly expressionistic.
Yes.
In that, you know, it's completely white. And as I'm sure, actually, I'll stop saying this, Blake. I was going to say, as I'm sure you're aware, but I've just assumed that you know certain things. This is all a constructed set, and the exterior is the High Museum of Art in Atlanta, Georgia, which again, just before this started, but I won't go into that depth. But of course, you know, man's interest in, you know, distinctive architecture at the beginning. So you have the, he chose that. And then obviously, you know, when he created the cell, he's following the exterior of the High Museum of Art internally. So with this cell, I find it very hard to believe, again, that you'd have a real cell that would look like this, you know, to, you know, this clean. But of course, that's the point. Just like in and clinical, just like in Science of the Lambs, because it's more of a extremely dark fairy tale, and you have a literal dungeon. He's down in a dungeon underground,
and it looks like a castle. The exterior of that building.
That's what it felt like to me with the stone. And again, when people compare the two, I get it. One saying one's better than the other. I don't even see it like that. It's just two directors who have a very different conception of their material. And of course, Manhunter as a novel was a very straight and groundbreaking procedural, but Science of the Lambs, it started shifting more and more into Lecter being a larger than life figure. I mean, he's even virtually portrayed as Dracula or a vampire in Science of the Lambs when he's killing the two guards. Even
well, and Ridley Scott takes that to the universal movie monster.
And there you go, level. As you said there, with someone literally calling him one of the would-be assassins, calling him Shaitan in Hannibal, where it becomes, you know, real grand guignol. So anyway, with this is more in man's wheelhouse, you know, Red Dragon as a property or as a novel. So right at the beginning, you have Graham framed in his dark, you know, in his dark clothes, framed within that window.
Yes.
And then framed within the bars. And just this incredible claustrophobia beginning before he's even come into the cell. And I think also the walls are detachable, which become important with the placement of camera as well as we go on. So that shot there, I find that extremely distinctive again. As he comes in, and the way that, you know, Mann and Spinotti, I'll just say Mann from now on, but of course, huge respect for Dante Spinotti, but, you know, coming, they've, you know, placed it in this very strange position, low level, looking up at him. And of course, you know, you've got this wide expanse of white, and you've got this dark figure caught within the bars again as he comes in too. I'll talk about his clothes in a moment. Again, the way he comports himself, it's almost like he's at a job interview, and he sits down kind of respectfully, almost quietly.
I love the gesture of the tie. That's very job interview, you know, just making sure everything's put together, even though he couldn't look less comfortable in a tie.
Movie,
right?
Definitely. And of course, the important thing about this with the costuming throughout the film and the color scheme is, of course, the green, the sickly green throughout the film, which is always linked with Dolahide at his home. But you see it there with Will Graham with the green shirt, reminding us of Dolahide, reminding us of what's at stake for Graham himself with his sanity. I mean, he essentially is a good man, but and I don't think he ever would tip over completely. But of course, you know, the major part of the film is his worry about his mental health problems overcoming him again after his first encounter with Lecter. And in fact, in one of Mann's cuts of the film, I presume you've seen this though, when you actually have, and it was a great idea really, but I can see why they cut it. When you have Mann turn up at the next target's home.
Yeah, that's actually one of the final scenes in the director's cut. It comes in just before we see Graham at his home, you know, with the turtles and his stepson with Molly, and the end, the sort of more uplifting ending of the film. You see him go and visit the people who aren't dead, the next victims, and it is a chilling scene.
It is the people they were, you know, the people that he's been trying to save throughout the film, but of course the way it's depicted is that the wife actually, if I remember correctly, she's startled or worried by him looming in the doorway. And of course he's scarred. His face is scarred and he does look intimidating. So of course, maybe Mann thought he was over-egging it the first time. I don't know, or the studio didn't want it. But of course it drives it home about his fear of becoming like Dolarhyde or indeed like Lecter. The other thing is with his black suit, it's also corresponding to Cox's slicked black hair as well in the cell, which is very distinctive. I mean, Cox had very, very black hair anyway, so I doubt it was dyed at the time. But I also find that corresponds again against this white canvas.
Oh, yeah.
Now, here, I find this fascinating. It's just very unnerving. First, you've got the wall has been pulled up.
Yes.
And my students never noticed this. I said, "How's the camera there?" And they were confused. And then I said, "Well, look, you know," and we replayed it. And they went, "Oh, I don't get that." And then I explained about, you know, the way you can move the walls because it's a set. But just the way man is literally controlling his environment. And we're over the shoulder now. So we're in there with Will. But we're presented with this very strange image in front of us where the person is obscured from us by the lock or whatever that mechanism is. You see his black hair, you see the hand up, and you see his body turned away from us, turned away from Will. And again, it immediately tells you something interesting about Lecter in that you enter on his terms. He knows damn well that Will's coming. He's heard him come in. But he will choose when he wants to turn around and present himself to Will. And so it's immediately just controlling the scene.
Controlling the scene. And it's also, you just, I definitely haven't said this yet, but it's also, it's very primal because really strong, unthreatened predatory animals will often flash, you know, vulnerable, you know, their neck or their back, or they'll put their back to things that they don't, that you are not a threat. And so
that's very good.
And he couldn't be showing. He's literally like, his behind is facing him, his back is facing him.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Like you said, you've got his backside facing.
It's just like, you could not be any less of a threat to me.
That's
right. And that's all the inference. And then his hand always sticking up, and just the way that the clawing of his hand as he's breathing, you start hearing him smell. You know, that ASMR moment of this little scene is all, it always gets me. And especially, you know, this is why you're in the UK, I'm in Oz. Some of my friends in LA, especially recently after seeing them as we're recording this, rave about the special 70 millimeter print of Michael Mann's own director's cut of this. And they said, you know, and I can tell you, Andy, I might keep saying it just so that someday someone releases it for people like you and I to watch it. But they called it a religious experience.
Oh, I'd love cinema. To see
them. But just that idea of that, there are so few transfers on great, you know, Blu-rays or 4Ks or whatever the case may be that actually can replicate the sound of a cinema. Like there's no lost audio from the print.
And
feel like here, if you're in a dark room with this on a giant screen, that smell would almost feel like it would almost prickle the hairs on the back of your neck as you're watching this, right? It's magnificent. All right, let's keep going.
That's the same atrocious aftershave you wore in court 3 years ago.
Yeah, I keep getting it for Christmas.
That's so good.
It immediately begins loaded. And yes, this is why I was, you know, incredibly loaded. And, you know, I had to explain, obviously, the context of what Lecter had done to Will. And then, of course, the court case. So first you're getting, obviously, that he can smell him. He's literally smelling him. And, he's, you know, which is unnerving in itself. Of course, he is wearing aftershave. But, you know, nevertheless, he's referring to smelling him. He's, and of course, this will actually bookend the scene, as you know, with the famous smell yourself.
Yes.
So he's smelling him and he's immediately he's such a sadist. He's immediately bringing up the courtroom case where Will would have had to relive everything. But then what's crucial for me is when Will goes, I keep getting it for Christmas.
Yes.
And he's immediately actually made a mistake. And
yes,
Lecter starts intuiting that later. But of course, as you know, he's probably, well, as far as I'm concerned, he is. He's getting it from his son.
Yes.
Because his, actually, it's his stepson, isn't it?
Yeah, his stepson. Yep.
He's getting it from his stepson. And of course, it made me laugh because I indeed, at that age, I kept getting my dad aftershave because he was a man. He shaved. I always watched him shave. So I get him aftershave. And of course, I got him exactly what Lecter says, a ship on the bottle.
Ship on the bottle.
Old Spice.
Yeah.
And that's always makes me laugh. And the way Lecter begins, anyway, he's Will's already fouled up as far as I'm concerned. The minute he's gone in, he's already said something he shouldn't have said that's personal. And I'm not sure he even realizes it.
He hasn't. And again, it might be that thing, the lure of like, he's so unthreatened. And maybe you don't see the threat, right? Like the threat's right in front of me. And he's just like, he lets that out. Maybe it's cordiality. Maybe get him to turn over. Maybe I'm still in control. But we know that he's not.
And I liked atrocious aftershave. That made me laugh. he's immediately putting another blade in him all the time. Atrocious aftershave. And of course, it's his stepson's choice. So he's mocking his stepson, you know, whether he knows it or not.
And also as a kid who definitely bought aftershave or perfume for parents at Mother's and or Father's Day, it's like, wait, did I have atrocious taste?
Which I realized I must have later, especially seeing this scene. So Lecter was upsetting me as well. Like,
yeah, he's not only jabbing Will, he's jabbing the entire audience. Bless him.
And then I'm ready to see you now. And then pulls down his jumpsuit and then is all ready. He's ready on his terms to talk to Graham.
And there's no fatigue in his eyes, Andy. There's not a lick of fatigue. Even though he sort of feigns it, we're going to see him feign it in just a moment. It's not a lick of fatigue. He's ready for this dance.
Because, as you know, he's bored stiff in them.
Oh, and the whole room is intended to strip away his sensory stuff. And so the minute he comes in, he's smelling, he's looking, he's ready, he's sharp. He's absolutely ready for this dance. It's magnificent.
Did you get my car?
I got it, thank you.
And how is Officer Stewart? The one who was first to see my...
There we go again. Did you get my card? I find it very funny. You know, I'm always careful with my laughter so the students don't think, you know, one of those teachers keep laughing at it. But I'd be chuckling away to myself every time I see it, you know.
And especially because his eyebrows shoot up. Did you get my card?
That's right. And that's actually it's very good as well, the way they've got him there, now that you bring that up. The way his eyes are looking up at him.
Yes.
You know, he's got the whites of his eyeballs underneath. And so he's staring up at Will. And, but of course, poor old Officer Stewart, the way he wants to relive that as well. And he refers to how he's showing you that he still gets pleasure of course he would, but he still gets pleasure from also the collateral damage that he's caused.
Oh yeah, he's relishing
it, which I find chilling.
Oh yeah, and especially because it's now not only the pain that you've inflicted on Will and that you can do it, it's like if by sort of he's like setting the table for all of the carnage, right, that he's created. Yes. Here it's not just Will, it's a deeper trauma, because you know, if anyone has experienced trauma, it's not necessarily sometimes the trauma that you experience, is if you have it communally or with other people, you know, if a loss of a family member, it's the things that impact you, other people suffering as much as yours, right? That becomes a trigger to that trauma. So he's just like, let's just paint the whole picture here, Will, because that's all I've got is my imagination. And,
I think you bring up another good point though, about the film, which I respond to the older I get. It's also this fascinating story, this look at trauma, yes. You know, PTSD.
Yeah.
And this, you know, poor Will is going through, you know, he's still recovering and probably always be trying to recover. But, you know, it's about someone also, as you see in this film, he literally gets in this, at the end of the scene, he gets a massive panic attack.
Yes.
That's induced by Lecter. So you see what it's taking out of him. And how vulnerable, how incredibly vulnerable he is, you know, and Peterson's performance.
And, you know,
do you know who Cox based Elektra on?
No.
He based him on Peter Manuel, Manuel, in case you ever want to check him out. Peter Manuel was a American Scottish serial killer in, I think, the 50s or 60s. And Cox used him as his basis because Manuel actually, he killed a number of people and he actually represented himself in court as well.
Wow.
He didn't use it. And the judge was quite fascinated. Sorry, I keep using the word fascinated. But the...
He was a curio.
Yeah,
he would defend himself by
the way Manuel did it as well. He did apparently, inverted commas, a good job of doing that. So... But what Cox noticed was that Manuel knew, I know it sounds banal, but nevertheless, it's what Cox noticed, is that Manuel knew about good and bad, really understood that, but just didn't care.
Yeah.
And that's what Cox thought about when he was playing Lecter. You get these ideas of morality, which of course are artificial. You know, they're created by us, but we have to keep to it to have orderly societies. But of course, once you realise that they are artificial, the ideas of good or bad, Lecter just thinks that's all a joke, you know, and it doesn't apply to him. You know, he can do as he wishes to.
Yeah.
So that's who he based him on.
There's one last thing that I would say is very recently I was talking about Silence of the Lambs on one of our other shows on One Eat Media Productions. Folks, it will have to go back a ways before if they want to revisit it. And I just keep looking at this scene and I'm like, you cannot tell me that Demme or Hopkins didn't A, thoroughly enjoy Manhunter, or
Without doubt.
Because exactly as you said, the placement of camera, the tilted down, so the whites of his eyes, this widow's peak slit.
Yes. Oh, yes, that's right. That's a very good point.
It is literally beat for beat, shot for shot, so much of that preliminary Hannibal, you know, obviously Hopkins is doing something vastly different, but so much of the preliminary Hannibal that we see in Lambs.
Definitely. Even presentation, the way he presents himself, I'm sure it's the novel as well, but the way that there's this theatricality which is tampered down with Cox's performance, but the way he presents himself at the beginning, turned away, and then, of course, Hopkins very standing erect, very polite, but waiting for her. And Cox has been waiting for him as well, but turns away, you know, rudely to him, you know, on purpose. So both of them similar like that as well.
Mm. Absolutely. Let's keep enjoying this scene together. I'm loving talking to you about it.
Basement.
You too, Blake, would you?
Emotional problems, I hear. Do you have any problems, Will?
No. He's not exactly subtle, is he? Just wait right in. Emotional problems, and then No beat, just go say, you know, do you have emotional problems, Will? He knows damn well he has.
Why would someone have emotional problems after they were stabbed, nearly gutted, and possibly eaten?
The nightmare, of course, as you know. The
it would be like, it would be like your dinner asking you from the pan. Yeah. Oh, Jesus and
the nightmare is he's a he's a psychiatrist. That's what's scary as well. It's the, which, you know, Will's up against this psychiatrist who's, you know, an insane sadist.
I've just said, you know, is it any wonder that our generation who grew up on Silence of the Lambs and Manhunter don't go to therapy? I'm just like, guys, I've seen Silence of the Lambs. Why the fuck am I going to therapy? It's not happening.
Oh, Lecter Means, again, as well, while I'm at it, I mean, you've got the obvious gag with Hannibal the Cannibal.
Yes.
But Lecter, of course, meaning reader.
Yes.
You know, and this intellectual component and reading people like a book. He's always
Thomas Harris has the best names.
Yes, he does.
He names characters the best fucking names ever. Like Francis Dolarhyde, what a name.
Oh, that's such Clarice a good name.
Starling, what a name. Hannibal Lecter, what a name. Just you read his whole book and every character had Jack Crawford. Like just everyone has the best damn names.
Perfectly named.
Yeah, and Adelia Mapp.
Yes, that's right.
The best names, just so good.
A lot of thought. Also the thing that, again, I'm sure is obvious, but the guy's an evil Sherlock Holmes.
Yes, absolutely.
Just the idea of that, turning all that against you, you know, someone who is like that, well, Moriarty, I guess. But, I mean, it is Sherlock Holmes.
But if Moriarty ate people.
Yeah, that's right. But
he's already an arch villain, right? He's so smart.
But Holmes as well was helping police. He was a consulting detective and he didn't think much of police. He couldn't stand them like Paul Lestrade. Yes. He saw them beneath him. And of course, Lecter, you know, this black humour, he's this consulting, you know, psychopath which of course must be based on Ted Bundy.
Yeah, definitely. I think
he was consulted about the Green River Killer, wasn't he?
Yeah, I think Harris was on the cutting edge, just like Michael Mann was with behavioral science. And so by this time, obviously, David Fincher's Mindhunter does a lot of this, which is by this time they know that serial killers are being profiled in order to develop detection tools to find out about patterns of behavior and signals for serial killers. So absolutely, I think it's definitely an amalgam. He's just like picking all these different things. And even as people discuss, I've spoken to a couple of authors. There's a great Aussie sort of pulp crime writer named Candace Fox, who writes sort of gritty crime novels here in Oz, and I've spoken to her a couple of times, and as part of her research she's interviewed serial killers, and she talks about the feeling and the power and this constant kind of weird displacement of power. They want to always show you that they
Leland's, I've probably got his name wrong, the in Mindhunter, the real serial killer, he was massive.
Leland. Yeah. Oh yeah, I'm gonna get his name. I love the actor. I love the actor who plays him.
Well, the actor was great. He was a ex-primary school teacher.
Was he really? Oh my god. It's Ed Kemper.
Yes.
The actor is Cameron Britton, who
And he was superb. But Ed Kemper said in real life, I'll be paraphrasing it, but Ed Kemper, when he kept an FBI agent in his cell for a long time before he could get out. And Kemper said, I could rip your head off now before anyone gets to me. Going back to what you said, Kemper wanted power still, you know, and he's in the cell, and same with Lecter Hill. He's trying to exert whatever he can to have power over a situation.
Gosh. Can I just say, Andy, I'm quite comfortable on this side of the screen. I don't want to be in this fucking room with him. I don't want to be anywhere near this building, to be honest. My word.
Of course you don't. I'm glad you came.
My callers are mostly clinical psychologists from Cornfield University somewhere. Second raters, the lot.
Dr. Bloom showed me your article on surgical addiction in the Journal of Clinical Psychiatry.
Huh?
Very interesting. Even to a layman. I want you to help.
Oh, God, I love this beat. Andy, yeah. I love that beat. Even to a layman, and he looks at him, and he...
That's so funny.
His look is just like, I want to fillet you. That's what that look says to me. It's just like...
Cox really scares me.
He's a scary guy.
There's something... I mean, as a young man, he's very distinctive, very handsome. And here, you know, he's in probably early middle age. Still very striking man, but that intensity of his, I think he's even got green eyes corresponding to Will's, to the green, but I might be going over the top there. I can't see it too well. But it's just that stare. It's just incredible.
It's something that's a shame because he's so good when he's increasing his verbose, you know, like, you know, his voluminous presence because he's, you know, diminutive in stature. But yes. I think that when people rein him in, he's got such amazing tools. Like he doesn't need to project.
Well, you just brought up something interesting. Do you know how he auditioned for it?
Oh, tell me, please.
He auditioned with his back to them, the casting agent, and because he knew that it was the voice that was important.
Oh,
and
God.
He wanted them to concentrate on his voice. So he literally, actually, it's quite funny with the way the scene begins back to them. But he had his back to the casting agent and he just wanted them to listen to his voice because he knew that's what would be very important in the scene.
And how he modulates it. It's not, I'm not going to bat at you. Yeah. I'm not going to scream at you. I'm not going to act, you know,
completely.
I'm not going to be bouncing off the walls. I don't have to move. I'm scared.
That's right. That's right.
Nailed it.
Dr. Lecter.
Yes. I thought so.
It's about Atlantenburg. You read about it?
In the papers. I don't tear out the articles. I wouldn't want them to think I was dwelling on anything morbid. You want to know how he's choosing them, don't you?
I thought you might and have then some he, ideas.
Why should I tell you?
He cuts to the chase, but also when we cut back to Will, Will's got
we
his
can
eyes
see
down.
In this case.
Yes, he's downcast. There was a sort of like flicker, and then as you said earlier, it's like in trying to control himself, he's trying to stay composed.
Yes.
And now it's still like, just stay. You've got to be direct, but just stay.
Totally.
Stay in this. That's a great. Totally. It's a fun. It's,
look at it. Sorry, carry on. Sorry.
I was just gonna say it's funny because as people, if you've had to have a tough conversation at work. Or you've had to, you're having a tough conversation with a friend or whatever the case may be. There are definitely parts of your life, which is why I think this performance is so fantastic. There are parts of your life where you're like, I could get more emotional about this, or I could let my emotions get the better of me, but I have to stay objective. And that's what he's doing in this scene, except he's doing it in the most heightened sense possible, right?
Completely right. He's a pressure cooker.
Yes. Yeah, because you don't want to be there. You don't want to be.
Yes.
And also to your point of detaching the walls, especially this composition, I almost wonder if they even brought him forward like 2 inches because
it certainly feels like that or the lens that Spinotti is using. That's a great point. I hadn't thought about that until seeing it like that immediately. It's obvious.
Like that. It feels so close. Like it feels even closer now. And that's the implicit danger of the scene is getting closer to this guy.
And you've brought in another good point now with the actual technique now, or sorry, with the cinematography and editing, the part they'll play more and more is extremely important. Also, the fact that, and again, I know you've noticed it, but for our people who are listening, my students never notice about, they were wondering what that strange kind of image was in the middle there. And I explained to them that it was plexiglass.
Yes.
That there's glass there as well between the bars.
Yes.
They were confused. And I was saying it's just another little layering about how, you know, dangerous he is and what, you know, put this plexiglass around. I think, is that correct, Blake?
Yeah,
that-
it's just this little reflection. It's like you don't, and again, this is why I say that Demi had to study this because it's like, oh, I love the glass. I love him. I love, you know, I love, and there's probably moments where they it's not as emphasized that the glass is there because it just, again, the blistering clarity of that. But it's like, later on, he's like, oh no, I want to abandon the bars, but I want to have these like little tiny holes that he smells through, you know, because he's, you know, he's he's a sensory person, observer.
Driven by senses, massively. And of course, the beginning here now, of the fact that, of course, it's looking like that Graham is imprisoned.
Yes, absolutely. And it becomes more and more emphatic as the scene goes on.
Yes.
Let's get to this great exchange. God, I love it.
And there's another reason. Pray tell. Thought you might be curious to see if you're smarter than the person I'm looking for.
Then by implication, you think you're smarter than me since you caught me.
No. I know that I'm not smarter than you.
Then how did you catch me?
You had disadvantages.
What disadvantages?
You're insane.
Just the way he looks at him as well, the way he looks at him.
You're insane.
You almost feel sorry for him. The editing is just very amusing, though, how quickly the editing suddenly... In a film, in a scene that's so slowly, it's just slowly paced, carefully paced, you really feel that editing when the editing speeds up between them to the punchline.
And then it just hangs. Like, I know we're paused on it, 25 minutes, 13 seconds. William Peterson's face is Will Graham right on the screen for us as we're watching now. But I just love the beats in this scene. Anytime there is a pause, in Oz, as it probably in the UK, you know, if your friend ever parks too far away from the curb, you're like, hey mate, can you get me a cab
from
the curb? Or you know, you park, you know, too far away from the car in front, it's like a 747 could fly through it. So whenever I see this scene and these beats go on, I'm like, you could fly a 747 through this pause, you know, it's just a pause. It's so pregnant. You're watching it, you're like, this pause is magnificent, you know.
It's
just I would just love, again, talking about the purity of the cinema going experience, I would love to be in a cinema and hear people writhing in their seats in this moment. I would love it. It would just be delicious. I feel quite, like Hannibal Lecter in that sense. I want to see people writhing because it gets more and more uncomfortable with these pauses. I think it's just, as you said, editing mastery on show.
You are very tanned.
And then that brilliant comeback. Yeah. So you have that, as you said, you have that incredible pause. But then he comes back, and that malevolence on his face, and it just says, you're very tan, Will, which again, my students didn't understand. And I was explaining, I mean, they got it. They was just looking at him physically doing his Sherlock Holmes bit. But of course, what he's implying is, apart from that, you know, he's working out what kind of environment he might be living in now, he realizes he's inferring about that Will would be trying to get tans because of the scars that Lecter left him with.
Mm.
So he immediately gets that in as well. And then, of course, looking at Will in a moment, and he can carry on playing it through it in a sec, but coming in a moment, of course, he talks about his hands, but he's not looking at them, he's looking straight at him. So obviously implying that he's been doing a quick scan of him, he's taken in everything he needs. And he sees that, sees the way his hands have changed as well.
Yeah, he sees it. Like, sees, and he's not inspecting them. You know, like sometimes you shake your hand, you shake someone's hand to greet them. I've got lots of friends who work in trades and stuff like that. And you shake a friend's hand who's in a trade, and they don't have business person hands, they've got rough hands. And you can
feel
my
dad was a builder, and he had very rough, calloused hands.
Stepdad of mine when I was growing up, you know, my mum's partner at the time was a fisherman and had rough hands because all he did was handle, you know, what we call chicken wire and wood and using tools to scale and gut fish, etc. Very rough hands, and you remember it in that sort of sense memory, tactile way, but he's so observant that he can literally see the calluses. You know what I mean? Like, that's just an extra layer of sensory understanding. He can look at you and just gauge it from that, which is the more freaky.
Spooking Graham even more all the time, doing that to him as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, it would be freaky. Oh, your hands are rough.
It would.
If Your hands are rough. They don't look like cop's hands anymore. And that shaving lotion was something a child would select. It has a ship on the bottom.
There we go. And there we go. And then with the composition, because they're so close, when you actually see him, obviously, go, I mean, first Lecter going in for the kill, it's like something a child, right? But if, then straight after he says that, you know, on a big screen, it would have been very effective. You've got Will really rise, starting to rise, to use that word you used. And it really stands out when he does that. It's a and massive
he almost dips out of his blocking, you know? And so it's like breaking a rule. Like, you know, you wanted to stay completely his whole body and his whole head and torso in the frame. And that tilt to the side.
Because you see what it's doing to him. And of course, then referring to his stepson.
Yeah.
So this is the beginning for me, the proper beginning of Will starting to unravel before massively unraveling at the very end.
Yes.
He's losing his composure.
And he's leaning forward. This is just so great. He's just like, he looks
up at him there as well. Like, dead lips.
25 minutes, 31 seconds, stunning. And he just looks at him and he's just like, I've got you.
Yeah.
I have got you. You are in my room now. You're in jail just as much as I am now. It's brilliant.
The other thing, Blake, as well, is that Graham has a beard, so he shouldn't be really using aftershave.
Yes.
And to me, it's always been, though I have to admit, I think I got this from someone saying this because I hate taking other people's ideas, but I don't know who it was for a long time ago. And someone described it as that he wears the aftershave as a lucky charm.
Yeah, that's great.
It's like a talisman. And I always like that because it doesn't make sense that he is wearing aftershave. Lovely that his son got it. Yeah. But he's obviously puts it on himself, you know, as I think almost ritualistically.
Yeah, absolutely. A little ritual. You know, thanks, son. And you just do it. It's like,
that's right.
It's like my keychain is disgusting because my children buy me very, very garish keychains that are so nice, you know, around Father's Day that say like cool dad or something. Yes. And they're always the worst, but you just, the keychain grows because the kids like it. And it's like, it's a habit. I don't need it by any stretch of the imagination, but that's what it is. And I also think it's just like, this is a guy who is trying, you know, cologne to me is composure as well. It's like, I want to control the scent that you have. I don't want to feel like I'm sweating. And he's after a guy who's, you know, lived in the Florida Keys, you know, Marathon, Florida. This is a guy who is accustomed to shorts. And so, you know, that masking of my bodily scent as well. It's like two things. It could be ritualistic.
That's a great point about the sweating.
Yeah, just like I want to make sure, you know, I am my background is Maltese. And so one thing I do well is sweat. And so I understand the need to dampen the musk of my natural scent.
That's right.
So,
that's,
you know, especially as like a hirsute guy, he's there. He's maybe just, you know, but for Hannibal, it's offensive. It's great. Great. All right, let's get into this. This is the good stuff.
I don't think you can persuade me with appeals to my intellectual vanity.
I don't think I'll persuade you at all. You'll either do it or you won't. Besides, we have to have room working
there briefly. Graham can be actually, I mean, he snaps back there and he can be strong again. And I also like, of course, the way that Lecter's constantly making subtext text. It's like enough of this bull, you know, let's just talk straight. Why are you even trying this on with me?
Why this Mickey Mouse bullshit? It's very Michael Mann. Yes. No Mickey Mouse that's bullshit.
Right.
It's just like,
that's right.
And same with Graham. You'll either do it or you won't. Like that, them level setting with each other that they're no longer bullshitting from like
that's
this
right.
moment is great. Because as you said, it's like now the game, the game is afoot in the Sherlock Holmes thing. It's like
yes,
the game
exactly.
is afoot. Like, okay, cool. We're not playing games anymore. You know, the game is afoot, but we're not playing games with each other anymore. We know where each other stand. You're going to do it. I know it might appeal to you in some way, you know, to cherish carnage because you have to live vicariously through it. And so, yeah, that's where we are. It's really, really great.
Do you have the fire with you?
Yes.
Pictures?
Yes.
Let me have them and I might consider it.
No.
And then I love that. Very simple and direct though, but forcefully. No. Yeah.
No. Just, and then it's that tilt. It's like, all right, we're going to play this game here.
Yes.
You're not going to boss me around. I'm going to tell you when I'm going to give you the file.
Yes, that's
really
right.
Really nice. Really nice. I love how his mouth is open.
Yes, that's right. I was just thinking that as like, you were saying that.
He's a gog. He's like, huh? Like, what are you doing? What are you doing? And he's his totally eyes done. Shift. It's so great. It's just such a brilliant touch. It's like, you got the files? Like, he's so casual that his mouth. What a brilliant actor. My God. What a gem. What a gem we've been able to watch for near 60 years. Unbelievable.
Dream much, Will.
Here we go.
And then that, the eyes flicking up. And dream much, Will. The way he keeps, every time he's, if he's not, the minute he's knocked back in any way,
yes.
He immediately puts in this shiv in between these ribs. Dream much, Will. What a terrible thing to say to Will.
Of course he does. And it's the great line from the first season of True Detective, which I adore. It's like, yes. I don't sleep, I dream. It's just Will Graham. That's Nick Pizzolatto tipping his hat to Michael Mann. He's such a fan of Thief, famously, but he's like, you know, that's a dream much, Will. I don't sleep, I dream.
Goodbye, Dr. Lecter. You haven't threatened to take away my...
Now, this is a shot you're talking about.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, always stood out for me. How do you see that shot, by the way?
Well, I love that... So there's two, like, sort of two technical and artistic choices here that are happening. One is that the room feels so much bigger and wider when he comes in. So it is literally, and you know, possibly literally, that the walls are closing in. You know, this entire sequence is closing in, and particularly in that midsection of the bars. Now we actually do see a little bit of the reflection. So I'm sort of moving my cursor along. That's where the, you know, up the top, you can sort of see where you know, right at the top, there's no need for plexiglass, but right in the middle where he's obviously his height is and his hands can get at you. That's where the plexiglass is. But it's then this, it's the move that it looks more like a piece of surveillance footage to go up. So below.
Yes, that's very good.
You know, as you as a teacher and an educator, you know, the very obvious thing is when you're looking up at someone, they're usually in a position of power. And when the camera is boring down on them, whether
that's
it's like surveillance footage or not, that they're being squashed. And so here it's the first time that Will actually feels like he's being visited by Hannibal Lecter and he's in the cell. And it's not a gesture. He's trying to escape the cell, but it's actually looks more like we're looking at Will in his own cell. Like it's a piece of footage. This would be where a camera is to see that Will is in this, you know, solitary confinement as Lecter is. So for me, it's this moment where he's now in the cell and the walls are encroaching in and everything seems smaller and closer and the threat is increasing.
That's how I see it as well. I like the CCTV comment as well. I haven't thought of it like that.
Yeah,
I
always wonder, you know, in a more contemporary setting, it's like, how many damn cameras would be in here? There'd probably be six, you know.
Oh, really? They do use them with some of the most dangerous. They have 24-hour surveillance with cameras, everything.
They'd want them all, the motion detection, all that sort of stuff, little things mounted high, untouchable, all those sorts of things. Just, and, you know, they're ever tampering with them, they'd be right in there, you know. So it feels more like that, and it kind of gives us a glimpse.
The books, yeah? Let me have the file and I'll tell you what I think.
And look at that shit-eating grin, Andy. Fantastic.
And the way he's studying him, you know, way he's holding himself again with his interlaced fingers. He's just studying him as if he's on under a microscope.
he's just like, I've got you on a platter. He's so happy. He looks happier than my son when he gets to eat cake. You know, he's so happy right now.
Can I ask you a quick before I forget, I've got to ask you a question. This is obviously probably because I've watched it too many times. I got way too obsessed with that. why is Lecter wearing two pairs of socks? Have you ever discussed that with anyone?
I think it's just because, no, I haven't discussed it, but I think it's because this is the one thing that my read on it is Baltimore's cold. Like, although this is Atlanta.
I was wondering if it was as simple as that.
It could just be that. But also, I think it might just be that he's wearing a couple of pairs of socks as well. It's just because of the it could even just be purely an aesthetic thing. They want his feet to look bigger. I don't know, maybe because he's a diminutive guy.
I was always wondering, but I'm sure it is as simple as that as well. But I think it always reminds me, it's a purely personal reaction, by the way, this. but it always reminds me, of course, the way that in the novel, the way he took off his shoes. Yes. And he comes up behind Will in his socks, you know. It always reminds me of that, the way he's coming up behind him with his socks and a knife.
Yes. Nice. That's actually probably the best touch. And again, we're now in this sort of impossible side of this beautiful movable set. And again, Will seems closer to Lecter than ever right now.
He does.
He's just loving it. And he already knows the outcome. I'm going to get this file.
Yes, yes.
I love how many times Barney's eyes flicker up and down when he's close to this. He's flickering like, you know.
Oh, God. I found that bit when you just show when you see him through the cell with that bar going down his nose and that look on his face, I find it really scary. Something about it.
And as you said, if it's about the Will sneaking up on Will from behind in his socks,
when he
stands up, he doesn't make a sound.
It's also quiet.
Whereas all the clanging and the heavy boots and all that sort of stuff. Yes. And then he just gets up and he's deathly silent.
Yeah, again, like a panther.
I love this.
And then that bit there. And that, so you cut, and then the fact that he's got his eyes on Lecter most of the time throughout, or looking down, the minute you see him looking there to his left, it's extremely striking because you realise more and more than what he's there for, to immerse himself in the whole, I shouldn't really use the word, but the vibe almost of it all, that, you know, this is why he's here, to get ready again. And then you have this dissolve, which really stands out suddenly after this crisp editing, as you're taken into Will's POV properly. Yeah. And the ambient music coming in, something that Eno would do.
Yes.
And then I believe there as well, if you pause it, the way the, I think the, it's almost over dissolving as well, but I might be wrong. There seem to be a series of little dissolves. He's scanning the room. And then, of course, the green books, the green spine, this all bringing us back to Dollarhide again.
And they're all journals of American psychology, a lot of them. So.
That's right. And then the great bit about Hill, then that sudden cut.
Yes.
The way you're back with him, he looks distracted. He's been taken out of his reverie. But of course, what's also crucial, and it's been happening throughout the last minute and a half, the lens that they're using, it's becoming more and more out of focus.
Mm.
And you almost don't notice the bars there that are either side of his face. They're blending in with the white of the wall. Blake, just before I continue, it's pouring down here suddenly. Is that bothering you, the noise? No. Or can you hear it?
No, I can't hear it. All good.
Okay, so also, of course, you've got the crops close up. If you sped up this scene and went right through it, fast forwarding it, you suddenly realise that, you know, how you're being brought towards Will, you know, so much. And then Hill, you know, it's just very striking, and he's looking, suddenly looks back at Lecter. But this crop close up getting us ready for this final moment between them.
And I love the snapback. Such a snappy.
Yes, the snapback. It's just like bang, snap.
And it's like, it's the same as like when you try and capture someone's attention and they're staring off into space. The snap is so.
Well, I have a 7-year-old, so I totally understand that.
Me too. My God. Hey. We're talking here. We're doing something. Focus on one thing at a time. Here's
but that's a good point you said, because also it's like it's also meditative for him. He's almost gone into a meditative experience of Lecter's world as he's looking around. You know, you don't know what he's trying to pick up, and I don't think he does either, but he's just come to immerse himself for a while back in this world before he starts dealing with Dolahide or try to deal with Dolahide.
Yeah, he's looking at all the ephemera, even when he's so controlled. He's just looking around, and it's just what he does. He just sits in there and absorbs it, and which is why it's so poignant. Like he knows why he's there. Lecter knows why Will's there.
Well, of course, the important thing is, and I just loved it in the novel, and I wished they'd used it in one of the films. When he meets Lecter, of course, the time when he meets Lecter, when he realizes is because he's scanning Lecter's room as Lecter's talking to him. And of course, he spots the wound man, the medical painting from the 19th century behind him.
Yes.
And realizes that the injuries correspond to the victims, and he immediately realizes it's Lecter.
Yes.
But of course, brilliantly, he makes his polite, you know, said, okay, thank you, doctor, I've got to go. And then, of course, when he goes out, Lecter looks around, because of course, he's been watching Will carefully without noticing, and then looks around at what Will's been scanning. And then, of course, he too knows and goes after him.
Yes.
Shy boy, Will.
Shy boy.
What were the yards
shy
like?
Shy boy, Will.
Big backyards, fences, hedges.
And then, of course, the mirror, you know, just obvious, I know, but again, the crop close-ups on either side, it's becoming more and more of a mirror reflection now, which I know is an obvious motif.
It's so affecting, though. I think
it works for me it works for me with man time with
it. Absolutely. I think also
with the infrared and heat when he's looking at De Niro, that's just an interesting way of doing it. This old idea of looking at but doing it as a negative image of yourself. Just that was terrific, and I love it here.
Yeah, I love it here, and also I think I can't remember who was talking about it. And I maybe was watching, could have been like a documentary about like famous violinists working for like orchestras. And they were just talking about, there are some violinists who come in when they start working in an orchestra and they've learned, they're very technical and they've learned how to do notes quickly and play extremely complex things. And then what they learn as they become, you know, as they join the orchestra is that the sort of magnificent first violinist, it's not just about the ability to be technical. It's about to playing with such precision and clarity of like really simple things that help to anchor an entire audience. I feel the same way with film techniques. It's like there are very powerful motifs and techniques that are used. And if they're used and deployed perfectly and harmonized with the story, they're fantastic. You know, they work every time for a reason. And that's why, because
this is what irritates me about people. It's not irritates, everyone's entitled to their opinion.
I'm going to correct you, Andy. It's irritating.
I should have the strength of my convictions. But when they say it's too stylized, I don't get what people mean with that. Like Wes Anderson or Ken Loach.
Yes.
Everyone, they all have a good filmmaker has their own, you know, very much individual personal style. And the style for me for this works perfectly for what they're dealing with. Never understood that.
There's a great man, acolyte, I would say, author, film critic, a great French film critic, Jean-Baptiste Theray. I'm a huge fan of his work. He's recently written sort of contemporary book all about Michael Mann. And
could you send that to me afterwards, please?
Oh, absolutely.
Thank you.
He's wonderful, and he's got an upcoming interview that'll folks can just look back. He's got a special One Heat Minute where we talk all about his great book.
Oh, great!
And for that. So you'll definitely get a listen to this, Andy, before this episode is released. But
great.
One of the fantastic things that he says when he's good, Blake, he was saying a very similar line of thought to you, which I want to echo, and I'm in complete agreement with. He's like, Blake, for me, I'm French. I wrote my book in French. And even though I speak English and he can read it and speak it, you know, he downplays his ability to speak English, speaks English very well. He's like, there's something about something being lost in translation between what I'm saying in French and the way that the words, move together and my style is reflected that I can't control. It's just not the same.
Yes.
And he's like, and so when I think of it from an author perspective, a film author being a director here, he's like, the style and the way that you, your style comes out of you is everything. You know, and it's everything. He's like, so for me, style always supersedes narrative. It's like the style with which you interpret it is everything. And I think Michael Mann, that's what it is.
Very much so.
And we joke about it all the time on Miami Nice with my great co-host Katie Walsh. It's like, if you gave the Miami Vice 2006 script to another director, it would be garbage. It would be hot garbage. It would be the worst.
But of course, what the key thing here is, and I'm glad you said this because I meant to bring it up with you, Red Dragon by Brett Ratner. And you've got Dante. What amazes me, I was watching it recently before this, rewatching. Well, I couldn't watch all of it, but
it's diabolically awful.
I couldn't do it. But what upset me, but what really interested me was, of course, it's Dante Spinotti doing both. And I do not lay the blame at Dante Spinotti, because what is interesting is that Spinotti obviously is taking his cues from his director. His director's telling him what to do. And this is why this, comparing it with Red Dragon by Ratner, is a brilliant example about style and about not having a style properly and, you know, form following function. But the key thing is Spinotti. They've both got Spinotti. This brilliant cinematographer, and how they use them is totally different.
If you look at Red Dragon, it's got Ted Talley, who won an Academy Award for Silence of the Lambs.
Yes, yeah.
It's got Dante Spinotti. It's got some of my favorite actors ever. Philip Seymour Hoffman, Harvey Keitel. I mean, it was Ed Norton at a time when, you know, just coming off of an amazing sort of 90s and early 2000s. It's got, I mean, you just name it. So many, Ralph Fiennes. It's got so many phenomenal actors. So many great people are in it. And it is just unbearably bad.
Yeah, it just doesn't work at all for me.
No, I agree. Completely.
But that's the importance again about the director.
Yes.
You know, when people go, you know, I get it. And I certainly get, you know, because obviously I deeply believe that film is a collaborative process.
Yes.
But what this shows, though, is that the director is, of course, the ringleader. And he has all these brilliant elements, as you said, in both films. And it's what they both do with them, what the choices they make and what they tell their team to do, you know, which therefore creates the style or whatever the style might be. And there's an ocean between the two of them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Let's get back to this glorious mirroring.
Because, my dear Will, if this pilgrim imagines he has a relationship with the moon, he might go outside.
The way that Will was intrigued there, just a brief bit, the way he's suddenly interested, you know, he's, you know.
Big backyards, why? And I love how he goes, well, Will, if this pilgrim... Will, if this pilgrim thinks he has a relationship with the moon, he might want to go outside. I love this next line. I have to play it.
Have you ever seen blood on the moonlight, Will?
It appears
quite black.
That's so disturbing. Have you ever seen blood in the moonlight, Will? It appears quite black.
And of course, you're coming in closer now as well as you're saying this. With those, again, red lips against the white outfit and background. Those eyes and the eyebrows as well. It's just so distinctive. And it is very vampiric again.
Yes.
If one were nude, it would be better to have privacy for this sort of thing. That's interesting.
I love that. I love that too. That's interesting.
I love that. That's interesting. He said this crazy thing to him. That's interesting.
It's the craziest thing that anyone has ever said. It's so crazy. That's interesting. Oh God, what a great response. We have to keep watching, but I just love it. I love that too. It's literally one of the maddest things anyone's ever said to anyone. Again, trying to keep that composure.
No, it's not. You thought of it before.
I considered it.
Yeah, and I love that.
You came here to look at me.
And he just does it.
Here we go. Yeah, now.
He drops it all. He goes, you know, he says, enough of this. You thought of this already. Enough, you know. I know why you're here.
I know why
you're here. And then you really see him start to get very twitchy.
And it's very, that's a great phrase, very twitchy. And even though the camera is giving them distance, we're not comforted by the distance. The distance is only, it's almost a weird, like, inversion. It's like an amplification of, like, it's more intense.
And I should have said, Blake, as well, the way everything snaps back into focus, by the way the bars are more in focus now to a certain degree as this starts happening.
As it all starts to unfold. Yeah. Here we go.
Back again, didn't you?
I want your opinion.
There we go. I don't have just one those right shifts.
Yes.
His shoulders, his head, it's all coming apart.
And opening it up is actually now emphasizing the discomfort. Yes, he can't even sit still.
Totally right. The way the editor and the way man have made that decision to bring them back into a medium shot.
So great. And I just love, you know, the framing is so tight on the bars now. Everything is about bars through that view.
Well, when you have one, I'd like to hear it.
Can I keep this?
I haven't decided yet.
I'll study them.
I'll study them after I haven't decided yet, which means you've decided because I'm telling you you've decided. I just love that. It's just such a manipulative. It's so wonderful. Wonderfully. I'll study them. Sorry. I didn't say you could have it. I'll study them. It's just like, no, I don't care what you're saying at this point.
Yeah, and he does it in a lovely studied offhand way, you know, pretending he's been offhand about it all. I love it.
When you get more files, I'd like to see them too. You can call me when I have to call my lawyer. They bring me a telephone. Would you like to leave me your home phone number?
That's so funny, the way he delivers that.
Would you let me leave your home phone number? And then again, the great response. No.
No.
No, I don't. Absolutely not. No, you know, it might shock you, but I don't want Hannibal Lecter to have my home phone number. Thank you very much. You've already determined that I'm tan and that my hands don't look like cops' hands, and then you'll know the area code because if we're old enough, it's no longer mobiles and things like that. You used to know people's area codes. You could pinpoint, you know, where they were. I don't want you to know any of that information. Thank you very much, Mr. Lecter.
And of course, just constantly prodding him like this. Here we go.
Oh, I love this. That frame, 28 minutes, 7 seconds. He's still got that phone number. He's got his face. Great. Here we go.
Do you know how you caught me, Will?
Goodbye, Dr. Lecter. You can leave messages for me at the number.
Do you know how you caught me? The reason you caught me, Will, is you're just a light. You want the scent? Smell yourself.
Brilliant. Oh,
and again, this is again, that's something that I know is massively overused in films. You know, we're not so different, you and I, but of course he's doing it here to really hurt him, not just to say, hey, we're the same, you know, but he's actually saying, you like me, mate, you know, bad luck, you know, except, you know, you don't want to accept it that you're me. And then says, of course, smell yourself.
Me. It's almost the door's shut, and it's every time the door shuts, I think sometimes it's that sort of brilliant thing that happens in your mind where you conflate two things in your memory and you're constantly reminded of it when you watch this movie. It's a brilliant thing. It's like you always feel like he says it to Will and Will hears that. But what's even cooler is like you want the scent, Will doesn't have to hear it. He knows what's coming.
Yes, that's right.
And when the door shuts, he still says it and he's like,
yes,
you want the scent. And he knows that's what induces the panic attack. Smell yourself.
That's right. And I loved, like you just said, the way Will doesn't hear that. And he's in the cell and he says it. He finishes it off.
He has to. He's like, it's two halves of a sentence that Will knows. He knows that's the right end to. And
that's
And so in your head, you always remember that Will gets it just maybe before the door shuts. Like he gets it just as he's going out the door. But then you rewatch it and you're like, every time I find myself surprised, I get a nice surprise. I'm like, oh, he's so dripping with confidence that Will knows the end of this.
And the way he's, you know, he can't even get near him, but he's still induced and panic attacking Will within 5 minutes.
And that's that, you know, I just received this beautiful Silence of the Lambs 4K purchase for myself. I've been waiting for it to be released. And, you know, that's the whole Mig scene is like, you know, he swallowed his own tongue with Lecter just talking to him. So, you know, Will's in the scene for 6 minutes. Imagine 24 hours a day, 7 days a week with Hannibal Lecter getting into your head. You can understand why you might swallow your own tongue because, man alive. Look, Andy, this has been so fun. I just am so incredibly grateful to have been a
streamer. Thank you, Blake.
Today.
I've loved it. It was really good talking to you.
It was so great talking to you. This is
lovely
so
to be
fun.
Thank you.
So fun bouncing ideas off of one another. So fun just ripping apart these scenes in this way. And this entire Mindhunter experience, I've said it and I'll just keep saying it as we make it. This is so fun. For us as collaborators and doing this, that I feel like this definitely is something I want to keep doing in this way, because just literally pouring the scene over like this, you can unpack every little nook and cranny. It's so brilliant. So look, I just want to say a huge thank you for anyone who's listening. If you go to Rufus T Superfly, I'll actually link it in there so you can go see Andy. I will maintain his anonymity, so you'll only get to know him as Tom Regan's Hat or Rufus T Superfly.
Sorry. I can't
say that tonight. No, it's great. It's a mouthful, but it's wonderful. You attack cynical takes, you attack stupidity, and you bring joy to us. And you have impeccable taste. And I'm so grateful for all of your lovely support and shout outs and everything, and I just want to say thank you so much again.
My pleasure, Blake. Thank you very much. It's been a lovely listening to your podcast. As I said to you before, but I'd like to say it now as well, you know, during lockdown, I listened to all of your podcasts. I discovered you, and of course, I love Man, but it was just great hearing, when I couldn't see anyone, being able to hear you and this community of, you know, fellow enthusiasts and academics and actors, all just, you know, being not cynical and just talking about cinema in the most wonderful way. So thank you as well.
Oh, look, I am more grateful for the community that we've built on this show every single
day.
And you're a part of it now. You're probably already an honorary member, because I talked to you about Twitter and share your tweets and great takes and fun with so many folks, and they're going to be thrilled that you were part of the show, and I'm thrilled that you're a part of it.
It was an honor, Blake.
And look, thank you so much. Guys, enjoy Mindhunter. We'll be back with new episodes, doing two a week all the way until the end of the year. There'll be bonus video episodes on our Patreon, so you can check those out. And if you want to be a member, there's a small fee, but a very modest one for us to keep the chaos that we keep doing. But look, Andy, it's been a pleasure. Thank you guys all for listening.
Thank you.
And we'll catch you on another episode of Mindhunter very, very soon. This has been an episode of Mindhunter, the latest Michael Mann deep dive at One Heat Minute Productions. Thank you so much for listening. If you want to check out other deep dive series we've done on Michael Mann, go over to oneheatminute.com. You can find links to all of our previous shows, including One Heat Minute, The Last 12 Minutes of the Mohicans, Miami Nice, featuring Katie Walsh and I, and all modern Mann movies, including Collateral, Ferrari, Black Hat, you name it, it is there, and the Jimmy Kahn Eulogy, One Thief Minute. Plenty of shows over there. If you want to support everything that we do, we'd greatly appreciate it if you checked out our Patreon / One Heat Minute. Over there, you can see weekly new releases. One Hot Take is the show there. You can also see The Decade Project, where we look back 10 years on the films that are still hanging around, currently working through 2014. They'll be on the main feed at the end of the year, but if you are a patron, for as little as $1 a month, you're getting them all throughout the year. And most importantly, as this is a Mindhunter episode, Mindhunter video podcasts will be popping up. Not every single episode, but most episodes will pop up as a video podcast as a drop there, so you can watch and consume and see all of the frames and images that we're talking about in all of these episodes. Every little bit of your support helps. So sharing, talking to us online at OHM Pods, or for myself at One Blake Minute on Instagram and Twitter. Thanks so much for listening.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.